Tisha B'Av, so we will discuss the location of the Beis HaMikdash and the other Mikdashes before, and what we know today about the Makom HaMikdash and about the future. This has to do a lot with the Gemara Daf Nun Daled, which was yesterday's Daf. I'm trying to explain a few things in the Gemara. But before that, if you have your Hebrew PDF file with the source page, I'd like you to go to source number, we'll start with source number 4, and walk backwards. This is from the Gemara's Rechon of Kuf Yud Ches, and the Gemara tells the history of the Olam Moed and the Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara says like this, Tamar Abana, Yimei Olam Moed Shebamidbar, Abon Shana Chosarach. The Olam Moed in the Midbar was built by Batalo, stood for 40 years minus 1, meaning Bnei Yisrael were in the Midbar for 40 years, but the first year there was no Mishkan, so that's 39 years. Yimei Olam Moed Shebagilgal Adasri. Then Bnei Yisrael crossed over the Yarden and came into Eretz Yisrael, and the Mishkan stood in a place called Gilgal, which is right outside Yericho, and it stood there for 14 years. Sheva Shekabshu v'sheva Shechoku. 7 years that they captured the conquest of Eretz Canaan, and another 7 years for them to divide up Eretz Canaan among all the Shvatim. The Mayor of the will now be given Chamishim v'sheva. Now the Mayor doesn't go in order, but we will go in order. Nishtari l'shiloh shloshmos l'shiv m'chos ha'achas. From Gilgal, the Mishkan went to Shiloh, that's the Pesach in Sefer Yehoshua, in Perek Yitzchas, that Bnei Yisrael came to Shiloh, they put the Olam Moed over there, and the Pesukim did not tell us how many years the Mishkan stood in Shiloh, but if the Gemara subtracts, we know it's 480 years from Bnei Yisrael went out of Mitzrayim till the Beis HaMikdash was built by Shlomo. And if we subtract all the other years for all the other places where the Mishkan stood, you're left with 369 years where the Mishkan stood in Shiloh. In Shiloh, as opposed to other places, it was a permanent structure, but the roof was a temporary roof like in the Mishkan. So in Shiloh it stood for 370 years minus one. In Nob and Gibeon, Shiloh was destroyed. We don't see this directly in Sefer Shmuel, but we know from Yirmiyahu and from Tehillim that Shiloh was destroyed, and from there the Mishkan continued to Nov, and from there to Gibeon, for there it stood for 57 years, and after that the Beis HaMikdash was built in Yerushalayim. So that's the history of how it went. Now if we go to source number 3, the Gemara is Rechon Daf Kuf Yud Ches. This is the Gemara just before the one we quoted. There were three places where the Shechina dwelt in Israel: Shiloh, the Nov and Gibeon, or Beis Olam. The Shechina dwelt in Shiloh, in Nov and Gibeon, and in the Beis Olam, which is Beis HaMikdash. In all these places, the Shechina only dwelt in the territory of Binyamin. So, just let's remind ourselves, refresh our memory, Parshas Pinchas, Parshas Maaseh, when Bnei Israel came into Eretz Canaan, the Eretz Canaan was divided up into Shvatim, each Shevet got their own area, and it's in the territory of Binyamin is always where the Shechina was. Shanaim HaTzev K'chol Peifal of Kol Hayom. In other words, the Shechina will always dwell in the territory of Binyamin. Now, why was Binyamin Zocha that the Shechina is always in his territory? The Gemara doesn't tell us, but the Sefer tells us that there are a few reasons why he was Zocha to this. One is because he did not participate in the sale of Yosef. Another reason is because he's the only Shevet who was born in Eretz Yisrael, while all the others were born by Lavan in Aram Naharaim. And a third reason was because he did not bow down to Esau, or because he wasn't born yet. So those are three reasons given why he merited that the Shechina should be always in the territory of Binyamin. And the Gemara continues. Abaye said this over to Rav Yosef. Amar, Rav Yosef said, Chagra havle v'chaylil v'lo mitzkan. Chaylil, Abaye's father, had one son, and even that one son, he also... is not perfect. In other words, it brings Pesukim to show that Shiloh was not in the territory of Binyamin, but rather in the territory of Yosef, which is Rishon Tefan Rabbah. I'm not going to read the whole Gemara now, but basically, what his question was is, how could you say that the Shekhinah was in the territory of Binyamin when we see so clearly that in Shiloh, Shiloh is a city that's in the location of Ephraim and not the location of Binyamin. So he answered him. He says, look, it could be that Binyamin and Yosef split up the territory of the Mishkan and Shiloh, just like in the Beis HaMikdash, the Sanhedrin was in the territory of Yehuda, and the Shekhinah was in the territory of Binyamin. So likewise, the same thing could be by Shiloh, that was the same story, they split it up. So he asked him a question. He told him, he says, it just doesn't work, because in the Beis HaMikdash, it's true that Yehuda and Binyamin split up the territory, simply because the Beis HaMikdash was built on the border between Yehuda and Binyamin. So they split it up. But when we come to Shiloh, the Gemara knew for sure that Shiloh is way farther north than the territory of Binyamin. Not even close to the territory of Binyamin. It's much farther north. And if it's much farther north, how could the territory of Binyamin reach to the Mishkan of Shiloh? And the final answer that the Gemara gives is that there was a Ritzua Nafka. There was a small strip that went out from the territory of Binyamin and reached all the way up into Ephraim to include that small place where the Mishkan was. And the Gemara brings the proof, because we see this also by Yehuda, and that there was a small strip of the territory of Yehuda that went in the territory of Binyamin and the Beis HaMikdash, and that's what was built. So again, the Gemara basically is saying that the Mishkan of Shiloh was built in the territory of Ephraim, but there was a small strip coming out from the territory of Binyamin that reached up all the way north into the territory of Ephraim, and the Mishkan was built in a territory that belonged to both of them. To date, there has been no remnants found of the Mishkan of Shiloh, but there are a couple possibilities of locating the Beis HaMikdash. I refer you to the source page. I have actually two pictures over here. The source page number 3, possible location of Mishkan at Shiloh. Possible location of the Mishkan at Shiloh, and over there you see a small blue rectangle in the back of the picture. Small blue rectangle in the back of the picture, and that's supposed to show the location, the supposed location, or the possible location of where the Mishkan of Shiloh stood. Now, this picture is not such a good picture. I go on to picture number 4 from the source page, and that's an aerial picture. And the aerial picture is also confusing, but I hope that with the aid of both pictures, you'll be able to figure it out. Because if you look at the aerial picture of Shiloh, you're looking now at the hill of Shiloh. Let me just say that this is a positive identification of the city of Shiloh. We know it from old sources, and how it was named Ceylon, north of Yerushalayim, south of Shechem. It fits the description, Sefer Shoftim. There is no doubt that this is indeed the city of Shiloh. And if you look at this picture, on the top of the picture you see a small road, a dirt road, that surrounds the surrounds the hill from 3 sides, and if you go a little farther down, you see the contours of the hill, and just below that you'll see a straight line that cuts into the rock and sharply cuts the contours of the rock, and that's a small strip that's just wide enough to fit the Mishkan and the yard in there. It's a small shelf on the mountain. It's obviously cut out, and already Wilson from the Palestine Exploration Fund 130 years ago, he already suggested the possibility that the Mishkan of Shiloh stood over there. To date, I shouldn't say no excavations were done, because there was a experimental excavation, and they did not find, they found pottery from periods later than the Mishkan. They didn't find pottery from the period of the Mishkan. I hope one day to do a complete excavation and then see if this indeed the place or not. But logistically speaking, it's a very nice location. It's not on the hill itself. It's outside the location of the city. It's north of the city. And there's a lot of parallels between that location and the location of where the Beis HaMikdash was built in Yerushalayim in comparison to the city of Yerushalayim. because when David HaMelech, when Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, he built it north of the city of Yerushalayim then, and he incorporated it into Yerushalayim. So that's what we know about the Mishkan of Shiloh. Today there's a Jewish settlement called Shiloh. The shul over there is built to show what the Mishkan looked like. As I said, the Mishkan stood there for 369 years. It was not a temporary location. It was a more permanent location with the Aron. The Gemara later on, the Zvachim, will say that the Pasuk says, Kilo Vasa Madato, you have yet to arrive at the Menucha and the Nachlo. So it's coming to tell us that there's two times that Klai Yisrael basically had Menucha, his rest, and Nachlo is the place of inheritance. One of them is Shiloh, and one of them is Yerushalayim. So, as we said, this is in Shevet Ephraim, but there's a small strip that goes out from there and goes all the way up north to from Binyamin into Ephraim. Shiloh was destroyed, and as I said, it does not say so explicitly in Sefer Shmuel, but all of a sudden Shiloh surprisingly disappears. In the beginning of Shmuel, there's Eli and his sons are in Shiloh, and then when the Aron is taken captive, there's no more mention of Shiloh. But the Mishkan moves on to a city called Nob. Nob today, we don't have a positive identification. It's probably somewhere north of Mount Scopus or the vicinity of Mount Scopus. We do not have a positive identification, but that is clearly in the territory of Binyamin, beyond any doubt. Nob was eventually destroyed by King Shaul, who wiped out the Nob Yerikonim, and from there the Mishkan went to Gibeon. Gibeon, we do have a positive identification. It's a small village north of Yerushalayim today called El Jib, and it's been excavated, and inscriptions over there show clearly that we're talking about Gibeon, and we know from Sefer Shmuel that there was a big pool of water in Gibeon, and they indeed found the big pool. Today no water, but there was water in ancient times, and that's also in the territory of the Yemen, beyond doubt, and it's clearly visible today. I wouldn't recommend to visit it directly, but if a person goes up to Nebi Samuel, the traditional capital of Shmuel HaNavi, he can see the city of Gibeon right in front of him. So those places are clearly within the boundaries of Binyamin, and that is no doubt. Gilgal also, even though the Gemara doesn't mention, Gilgal is in the outskirts of Yericho, and Yericho is also in the territory of Binyamin. So we don't have a problem with that. Now we get to our Gemara, and we get to discuss the issue of where the Gemara talks about the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and whose territory it was. So let's go back a little in history. After Shiloh is destroyed, we come to Nov, and Shaul is appointed king. And the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that the three mitzvahs that Bnei Yisrael are obligated to do when they come into Eretz Yisrael, one of them is to wipe out Amalek, the second mitzvah is to appoint a king, and the third mitzvah is to build a Beis HaMikdash. The pasuk also says in Parshas Re'eh that Hashem v'niach lecha mikol oyveichem misaviv yishavtem betach. Hashem will you'll have peace and security from your enemies, and then v'yah ha'makom asher yivchal Hashem, and then you'll take the place that Hashem chose and build a Beis HaMikdash over there. In other words, the prerequisite for building a Beis HaMikdash is that there's peace and security, and not when you're at war. I want to add a personal thought. I'm not sure that this is true, but it's very possible it's true. Why is this a prerequisite for building a Beis HaMikdash? Okay, one could say simply, they don't want to build a Beis HaMikdash whenever there is war. The danger of destruction of Beis HaMikdash is greater. But it's talking, but there's also another idea. When Bnei Yisrael went out to war, they took the Aron. And they took the Aron out to war, as we see in the days of Eli, and they took it out for other wars also. Like, which Aron, whatever, were there more than one? That's a whole discussion, and Machlokas Tanaim. But the question is once the Beis HaMikdash was built, did they actually take out the Aron again to go to war or not? And to me, it would seem that the answer is no. And that's why the Gemara says that the Menucha, the Beis HaMikdash is called Menucha because it's Menucha Sa'aron. The Aron rests. In other words, this is the final stop of the Aron. You don't take it out again. And therefore, you have to wait until there's peace and security and no threat of war. And then it comes time to build the Beis HaMikdash and comes time for the Aron to come to its permanent location. Because building it before the peace and security, the Aron has to go out to war. It just contradicts the concept of the Beis HaMikdash. The thing that gives the Beis HaMikdash the power that this is a place to be Makom HaKarbon, one of the things is the fact that the Aron is there. The second Beis HaMikdash, we didn't have an Aron, but the Aron has a power, as the Meshech Chacham says, that you can be Makom HaKarbon in the presence of the Aron. And so again, the resting of the Aron is a prerequisite for building Beis HaMikdash. So it comes time after when Shaul is king, that's when the scramble comes. Everyone realizes that the Beis HaMikdash is going to be built. Until then, there's no king, and when there's no king, there was no mitzvah of building Beis HaMikdash. But once there's a king, now it's time to build Beis HaMikdash, and now the scramble comes, and David, and as we see from the Gemara in the David on the base, which was yesterday's daf, even though I put it in the sources also, source number two, in the middle of source number two, but David then is kind of David Adomi. The scandal came because they're trying to figure out where to build the Beis HaMikdash, and an interesting thing is that the Navi will not tell us where to build it. The only way to build the Beis HaMikdash is L'shichno Sidrashu Uvas HaShama. You have to be Dorish first, you have to find the location, and then get confirmation from a Navi. That's what the Sifri says. So you can't ask the Navi where to build it, you're going to have to figure it out yourself, and then you get confirmation from the Navi. Now, why didn't they know the place of the Beis HaMikdash? If you look at source 6-1, it's the Rambam in Hilchos Beis HaBchira. The Rambam mentioned that this is the place that the Mizbech was built. It was a set place. And source 6-2, the Rambam says, in the source medical, it's tradition that the place that David and Shlomo built the Mizbech, that's the place where Avraham did Akedas Yitzchak. And that's the place where Noach was makrib when he went out of the Teva, and that's where Cain and Hevel were makrib, and that's where the Marishan was makrib. In other words, it was a traditional place where they were makrib. So you can ask, why didn't they know, how didn't they know where the Beis HaMikdash was going to be, that they had to have a scramble over here to figure it out. So it's a very interesting Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim. And it's source number 10, printed over here. This is the Rav Kapach edition of the Moreh Nevuchim. It's available on the internet in a site called Da'at, Ko'il. And the Rambam says like this, the Rambam says, V'chein in Sefer Gedaiti, he says, no doubt in my mind that the place that Avraham Avinu designated was known. So if so, he says, why didn't the Torah say explicitly, build the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim? Why didn't the Torah say, go and search for it and find it? Why didn't the Torah tell you right away, go to Yerushalayim and build it in the place where Avraham was makriv, etc.? So the Rambam gives three interesting reasons. One, reason number one, the Rambam says that the Goyim should not be aware of the holiness of the place. Because if the Goyim would realize that this is the holiness of the place, then they would fight stronger over this place to prevent Bnei Yisrael from getting it, knowing that this is the place. So that's, that this is the holy place. Reason number two, the Rambam says, is that the Goyim should not destroy the place, knowing that this is such a holy place, they'll do everything to desecrate the place. And reason number three, the Rambam says, "V'hi ha'yotzei chashuva," and this is the most important reason. So the Shvatim shouldn't fight amongst themselves. Bnei Yisrael are coming into Eretz Canaan, and 12 Shvatim, and if everyone would know where the Beis HaMikdash is going to be, so then they'll all be fighting over that spot. Everyone will say, "I want to get that spot." And there'll be a fight and a war. Just like in the days of Korach, they fought over who's going to be coming. And therefore the Rambam says the mitzvah to build a Beis HaMikdash is only after appointing a king. So that there'll be one person who'll be able to make the decision, and that's the king. And of course no one's going to argue with the king. So the Rambam says another reason is that the Shvatim shouldn't fight amongst themselves over who's going to get that territory. So that's an interesting reason in the Rambam, because we see from the Rambam that when Bnei Yisrael came into Eretz Canaan, they actually had no idea in what area in Eretz Yisrael at all the Beis HaMikdash was going to be built. So the Rambam says it. It seems to contradict a Gemara in Bava Basra. I'm not going to go into full detail, but I did print the source of the Gemara in Bava Basra, source 9-1 and 9-2, where the Gemara says that when they divided up Eretz Yisrael, they had to compensate the Shvatim. And what do they compensate him for? The Gemara says a seah of the Yehuda, a seah in Yehuda, and the southern Eretz Yisrael is worth five seahim in the Gullah. And the Gemara says, what was the problem? The Gemara says, the Krova Berachoka. The problem is that why do we have to compensate those in the Gullah that they should get five times the size of what a person got in Yehuda? So the Gemara says, the Krova Berachoka. We compensated them because they're far away, meaning share with Yehuda, the people around Yehuda, they're very near the Beis HaMikdash. So for them, traveling to Beis HaMikdash is close. For the person in the Galil, in those days it was, could be a good 2 weeks travel. So in other words, it's much farther for him. And in order to compensate him for that, so he got five times as much territory as the person got in Yehuda. So it would seem clearly from this Gemara that the people knew that the Beis HaMikdash were going to be built in the territory of Yehuda. And as you see, we saw from before, we knew pretty much that the Shechina will be in the territory of Binyamin. Okay, Binyamin didn't get right away at the beginning, but Yehuda got at the beginning. So it seems to the Gemara that even though they didn't know the exact particular location, but they still had an idea where it's going to be. Zebulun and Naphtali, they knew pretty well the Beis HaMikdash is not going to be built over there up north where they are. So, but that's what the Rambam says, that they did not know the location, and the Rambam suggests these three reasons why they didn't know the location. Okay, so the Gemara goes on, and this is the Gemara that's in the on the base. It is printed in your source page. It is printed in your source page, source number 2 in the Hebrew PDF source page. Baruch Rabba. My Dechsev, it says, Vayelech David Shmuel Vayeshu B'nayos Barama. David was running away from Shaul, and he ran to Shmuel, and this is the last time that he's going to see Shmuel before Shmuel is... was Mifta. So, the Chimani and Nairus and Rama, what's the connection between Nairus and Rama? In other words, one, they're obviously not next to each other. They were sitting that night, David and Shmuel, and they were learning one thing. The halachas of the Beis HaMikdash. That was the night that Shmuel HaNavi gave David HaMelech the blueprint of the Beis HaMikdash. David HaMelech says in the Vayomim, HaKol B'Chsav Yad HaShem Alei Hiskel. I have everything in writing, and he got this from the Masoros from Shmuel HaNavi. And that night they were sitting and learning, the Medrash told us that that night there were Mechadish things that an experienced Talmud cannot be Mechadish in 80 years. And they're sitting over there trying to find the location of the Beis HaMikdash. Omik Sivet says, V'kamta V'alisa L'makom, Melamet Sh'Beis HaMikdash G'vom Kol Eretz Yisrael. The Beis HaMikdash has got to be on the high point. So they didn't know where to find it. They went into Sefer Yeshua, where it describes the boundaries of Yehuda and Binyamin, and they found the Psukim, the Yorad, V'olad, V'shelet Binyamin, V'olaksiv, the Yorad Loksiv. When it came to Shelet Binyamin, it says the boundary went up, and it didn't go down, so they figured out this is the highest place. Amishmanin Ahochel in the Koma. So they said, if so, then this is the place where the Beis HaMikdash has got to be built, because this is the highest place. So they wanted to build it in a place called Ein Etam, the Madli, that it's high up. Only they said, no, Nitzi Beikoru, we're not going to build it in the highest spot, we will lower the drop, Kirchsiv Ubein Kesefa Shachet. It says that the Shechina dwells Ubein Kesefa between his shoulders. The shoulders are not the highest point in a person's body, the head obviously is, to show that the Shechina is not in the highest point, but on a site a drop lower. That's one reason. The Baisan and another reason. Gemir de Sanhedrin b'chalka de Yehuda v'shchina b'chalka de Binyamin. We have a Kabbalah that the Sanhedrin, and we saw this at the beginning of the Shir, the Sanhedrin is in the chalka of Yehuda. In the Beis HaMikdash there were three Sanhedros. There were two Sanhedros of 23, and there was the top Sanhedrin of Klal Yisrael, 71 members, that sat in a room called Lishkas HaGezis. And that, it had to be in the territory of Yehuda. V'shchina b'chalka de Binyamin. The Shechina, the Beis HaMikdash itself, and the Mizbeach, is in the Chalak HaBinyan. And if we're going to build the Beis HaMikdash in Etam, this split Tuba, they're too far apart, Yehud and Binyam are too far apart, and there'll be no way to connect between Yehud and Binyam at Ein Etam. Mutav Nitzi Beipurta, let's build it a little lower, Kirechsiv Uvein Ksef of Shachar, as it says, he dwells among the shoulders. So now they made a decision. If they're looking at the Pesukim superficially, it would seem to build it in Ein Etam, but they realize they have to, there's a problem, and therefore they decide to lower it, and that was Doeg's problem, meaning Doeg was also trying to figure out where to build Beis HaMikdash, and he had this dilemma. He didn't know how to solve it, and they solved it. And that's why Doeg was very jealous of David, that he was able to solve, David was able to solve what Doeg wasn't. So that's what the Gemara says. And then it says that David HaMelech sworn that he will not sleep in a bed until he finds a place of the Mishkan, finds a place in the Beis HaMikdash, and the Ramazan, they found it from Sefer Yoshua. Okay, so the Gemara says they wanted to build it in a place called Ein Etam. Where is this Ein Etam? So this is not a simple matter. We know from the Yerushalmi in Yoma and in other sources that there was an aqueduct of water that brought water to the Beis HaMikdash, and was higher than the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara in Yoma says it was 23 amos above the level of the floor of the Azara. 23 amos high. In the second Beis HaMikdash, archaeologically, we know that there's a place south of Beit, which is called Solomon's Pools, and from there, there's an aqueduct that brought water to Yerushalayim. Most of the scientists who try to pinpoint when the Gemara says Ein Etam, they say it's probably that spring of water that's south of Beit Lechem in Solomon's Pools. There's even a village nearby which is called Etam, mentioned in Divrei Yomim. It's mentioned in Shoftim, and with this they want to say that Ein Etam is sitting over there south of Beit Lechem. However, Rashi clearly does not learn like this. Rashi says a very interesting thing. He says, "Ve'en etam nira ve'en shumaya main of teach ha'om l'shalom asher achar aliyas ahar asher p'nei gei beninom." Rashi says, "When I come to Ein Etam, what is Ein Etam?" So Rashi says, "Let's look at the pesukim. I printed out the pesukim for you in the Hebrew PDF page, source 7.1. There's a description of the boundary of Yehuda and Binyam. Now this." Parshas Vav, the Hebrew source 7.1, is a description of the northern boundary of Shevet Yehuda. The northern boundary of Shevet Yehuda, which begins from the east, which begins from the Jordan River, from the area of Yam HaMelech, and it continues westward. Pasuk Ches, Va'ala Agvul Gei Ben Hinnom El Kesef HaYevusi Minegev Hi Yerushalayim. From Gei Ben Hinnom, it goes to the southern shoulder of Yevus, which is Yerushalayim. From there it goes up to the top of the mountain, which is west of Gehinom, which is north of Emek Ephraim. The Sa'ar Agvul Merosh Ahar and Mayan Menef Toach. From there, the boundary goes straight out from the top of the mountain, to the spring of Menef Toach, and from there it goes and heads out towards Kiryat Yearim. So Rashi says, when? The Gemara says that they wanted to build it in Ein Etam. Ein Etam is what the Gemara calls Main of Toch, is what the Pasuk calls Main of Toch. And from Moshe Har, you continue going, you get to Main of Toch. So that's Rashi's opinion, and that's Rashi's opinion throughout Shas and other places where Rashi refers to Ein Etam as Main of Toch. Many are surprised with this Rashi. Why? Because in modern days, there's a spring called Main of Toch, and that spring is way deep down in the valley. If anyone knows Yerushalayim, when you're going out of Yerushalayim towards Tel Aviv, on road number one, deep down in the valley, there's a spring of water over there called Main Eftorach. There's another village called Lifta over there. And that's deep down, way below the height of the Makom HaMikdash. So how could anyone try to identify Main Eftorach as the place at the highest point when that's clearly way lower than where the Beis HaMikdash is built? Okay, so obviously, one of our assumptions is wrong. Maybe our assumption that we identify this spring as Main HaKorach, that can be wrong. We know from Sefer Divrei Yomim that in the days of the war between Chizkiyahu and Sancheiriv, Chizkiyahu sealed all the springs of water in the vicinity of Yerushalayim. So in other words, today, we don't have access to all those springs of water that were accessible in the days of the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, it would be impossible for us to pinpoint the seven springs and say, this is definitely Main Eftorach, because four or five springs could have been sealed, and we really have no idea where those springs were. So, very possible that the Main Eftorach that is in the Pasuk is not the Main Eftorach we identify today, but it's a different spring that was higher up. But why is another problem here with Rashi? The another problem with Rashi is that if Rashi identifies Main Eftorach as Ein Etam, The Gemara says, what was the problem with Ein Eitam? The problem was that Yehuda and Binyamin were too far apart to build the Beis HaMikdash. But if Ein Eitam is a spot that's on the boundary between Yehuda and Binyamin, so how could they be too far apart? They're both, Ein Eitam and Menachtach is on the boundary. And if it's on the boundary, how could they be too far apart? The Gemara says they're too far apart. If this is indeed the Ein Eitam, so then it's right round smack on the boundary, and there should be no problem. So that's another question on Rashi. If we go back to the Gemara in Mem Gimel, Amud Beis, at the bottom, this is also in the Hebrew source page, source number one. I even bold-faced the small sentence where the Gemara tells the story. The Gemara says, that the Mizbeach took was one Amma in the territory of Yehuda, and if you look in the, if you have a Gemara's Rachim in front of you, and then Gimel on the base, you see the drawing in Rashi, where you see the Yisod going around the west and the northern part of the Mizbeach, while in the east and the south, all it has is one Amma. And the Yisod does not completely circle the Mizbeach. And the reason for it is because the last corner, the southeastern corner, was in the territory of Yehuda. And since it's in the territory of Yehuda, you cannot put the blood of Kabbonos in the territory of Yehuda. And the Gemara says the Mizbeach was with two also yotzei mechelko shel Yehuda. There was a small strip that went out from the chelko of Yehuda. The nechnasi mechelko shel Binyamin, and he went into the territory of Binyamin. And Binyamin HaTzadik mustar b'chol yom lenotlo. Binyamin HaTzadik was making every effort to get that one extra amma. Shenei mechol b'chol of kol yom. So this, the Gemara is saying, Binyamin wanted to get that extra amma. This is kind of strange. When the Shvatim got the territories, everything was pretty much, the demarcation lines were pretty clear. Everyone knew what they got. We never find that the Shvatim were fighting amongst themselves to get more territory and less territory. So what is Binyamin trying to get over here? If you go on with the Gemara says another thing. The Gemara discusses how could you be makir of OSO. It's in the territory of Yehuda. So the Gemara says they did an interesting thing. They made a rule that the ground belongs to Yehuda, but the air above the ground, that belongs to Binyamin. So clearly, there's some form of, I wouldn't say game, but there's clearly a possibility of maneuvering over here by making the ground belong to one shevet and the air on top belong to another shevet. So how does this exactly work? So, Baruch Hashem, I came up with an idea, and I later found that this idea has already been written in the Radak and in the Maharit, and the idea is like this. I have two sources on the Hebrew PDF page, source 79, which we read already, but we're going to read one more time. Source 71 describes the boundary, the northern boundary of Yehuda. The northern boundary of Yehuda is the southern boundary of Binyamin, because Binyamin was just north of Yehuda. And it describes the boundary from the east. Again, Pasuk Ches. Va'ala Agvul, Ge'i Ben Inom, Al-Kesef Ha'ibusim, Menegav Yerushalayim. The boundary goes south of Yerushalayim, meaning Yerushalayim is not in the territory of Yehuda. Va'ala Agvul, as Rashi says clearly on that passage, it went up on the mountain facing Gehinom from the west. It went up to the top of the mountain, and from there it went straight out to Menaftoch. This is the boundary, the northern boundary of Yehuda, going from east to west. Now let's take a look at source number 7-2 on the Hebrew, the next source on the Hebrew PDF page. This is from Yeshua Perek Yitches, and here we have the description of the southern boundary of Binyamin. The southern boundary of Binyamin is that same northern boundary as Yehuda. However, it gets tricky here. Trick number one, why it's tricky, is because over here the boundary is going from west to east and not east to west. It's going in the opposite direction. So that's number one. We have to note that it's going in the opposite direction. And number two, let's take a look. The southern boundary of Binyamin. It went to a place called Yama, which we don't exactly know how to define that. From there it goes to a spring called Menaftoch. And from there it goes down to the edge of the mountain. From Menaftoch, the boundary goes down to the edge of the mountain. So if we go back to the source of, to the Yehuda boundary, the source from Yerushalayim, it goes up to the top of the mountain, and from the top of the mountain it goes straight to Mein HaTzoach. But if we go to to Binyamin's boundary, which is in the reverse direction, instead of going from Mein HaTzoach straight to the top of the mountain, Asher Pnei Gev Eninom, and from there going down, it goes down to the edge of the mountain. So in other words, the boundary of Yehuda and the boundary of Binyamin over here are not identical. They're not identical, and this is as I said, the Radak and the Malit, where I say this is the trick. In other words, Shmuel has the blueprint of the Beis HaMikdash, and he has the blueprint. He knows exactly where the Beis HaMikdash, how the Beis HaMikdash is supposed to be built, where the Mizbech is supposed to be, and where the Sanhedrin is. And if you take it to a place called Ein Etam, in Ein Etam there's a clear demarcation line between the two Shvatim. If you take the blueprint, if you put it any way, it will not fit properly in such a way that one, that the Sanhedrin will be in the territory of Yehuda and the Shechina in the territory of Binyamin. It just won't fit. If you look at the way the boundary goes, it doesn't fit. But then, if you go to if you go down a drop, you get to a territory where the borders are identical. Now there's two possibilities. It can either be that this territory in between is a no man's land, or it's overlapping. One of the two. Now the Radak and the Malit seem to suggest that it's a no man's land. I know the topography, personally I would suggest the opposite, but I don't think it really makes much of a difference. The point is that since this territory is either no man's land or overlapping belonging to both of them, it meant that they will have the possibility of maneuvering to set up later on which Shevet will get what. It's not finalized. It'll be set up when the Beis HaMikdash should be built. That's how they'll set it up. So in other words, in this territory, in this no man's land, they can take the blueprint of the Beis HaMikdash, build it any way they want, and then we'll decide. If the Sanhedrin is here, this is the territory of Yehuda. The Shechina is here, this is the territory of Binyamin. They'll be able to move around. They can even play around saying that the ground belongs to Yehuda and the air belongs to Binyamin. In other words, there's a lot of maneuverability which they didn't have in Ein Etam. Because in Ein Etam, it was a set line. And it was a set line they could not play around. So that's why I think a lot of people have suggested different diagrams how exactly it works to figure out this boundary of Yehuda and Binyamin. They're taking maps and putting the Sanhedrin here and the Mizbeach here. And believe me, I've yet to see anything that's acceptable without any problems. All these approaches are problematic. And this solution, which is very suggested by the Maharit, means basically there's no way to determine, by looking at the map of the territory, there's no way to determine how it went. They made it tonight, they left it free, they said, we'll wait till we build Beis HaMikdash. When the Beis HaMikdash comes, that's when we'll be able to play around and move it around in such a way that part of it should be belonging to Yehuda and part of it should be belonging to Binyamin. I want to continue a little when we talk about the situation on Har HaBayis today, finding the location of the Beis HaMikdash. A Jewish scholar who lived over 100 years ago wrote a sefer called Rishas Tzion, and in it the possibility of the Mark of Kabanos, the Zman Hazeh, was raised. And one of the questions that he was asked was, how are you going to build a Beis HaMikdash and a Mizbeach when Mizbeach has to be built, as we saw, as the Rambam says, a precise location, and yes, the Drisha Tzion has just been recently reprinted. It was out of print for years. Moshe Rav Kook just reprinted it and fixed it up very nicely. And the question he was asked was, how are you going to build it when the Rambam says that the precise location of the Mizbeach is at a precise location? How are you going to find this location? So he suggested a few ideas. One idea was, he says, look, we have the Mishnah Maseches Midos, and the Mishnah Maseches Midos discusses the dimensions of the Beis HaMikdash, etc., and the Ezra. So no problem, we'll go and measure it. We know the walls of the Har HaBayis today, and we'll measure based on the Mishnah Maseches Midos, and we'll find the Mizbeach. That was a nice idea. It was a theoretical idea, but never was practical, for a few reasons. One is because the Mishnah Maseches Midos doesn't tell us how far from the walls of the Har HaBayis the Azara was. It doesn't give us a number. So that's number one. And the second problem was is that when they came to measure the walls of the Harabais today, the walls of the Harabais are much larger than those walls that are mentioned in Masechet Midos. So that caused another problem. We can give a whole share on this alone to discuss how exactly what happened here. But the accepted theory, based on Josephus, the Jewish historian, and other sources, is that when King Herod rebuilt the second Beis HaMikdash 100 years before its destruction, he added on wings to Har HaBayis from different sides. And today we have no idea how much he added on and from which sides he added on. And everyone is scrambling to figure out the answer to this question. Where exactly did he add on? So that's so that idea that our three-ish kasha had to simply measure and it just doesn't work out. I read in a recent one in the OU publication, The Jewish Action, Rabbi Resnick, wrote a whole article to prove how the remains of the Heichal were standing for hundreds of years later. The Jewish Kasha also suggested that perhaps remains that something in the Mizrach remains. With all due respect to Rabbi Resnick, Josephus clearly states that everything has been demolished, anything that didn't burn down in the fire has been leveled, there's nothing left, and unless there's proof otherwise, we'll assume that that's the way it was. As we say, V'chor Hashem Adom, Hashem Mishalayim, Ha'imim Aru Aru Atei Yisodba, to knock it down to the foundations. So that's also not such a simple thing to go and dig and to start finding where it is. There are a few possibilities where the today there are a few theories which people dwell upon. If you go to source number 7, if you go to source number 7. If you go to source number 7 on the, this is the right one. If you go to source number 7 from the source page, this is an aerial picture of our bias, which is on a site, I think, called templemount.org. And what you're looking at over here is the top platform on our bias today. In the center, you have a building called the Dome of the Rock. With a big B marked on it, and to the right of it you have a small dome which is marked A. This rock over here, this dome of the rock, and if you could jump to another source, source number 8 on the source page, you will see a picture of the rock from inside the dome of the rock. And the reason why this building is called the Dome of the Rock, it's an hexagonal building, an Islamic building that was built 1300 years ago. And in the center of it, take a look at the picture over here. In the center of it, you have this rock which is protruding from the ground. This rock is clearly the highest point on Har HaBayis today. It's the highest point on Har HaBayis today. We know if you add the Hebrew source page, in the PDF, Hebrew source page, source number 8, and mentioned in Mishnah Yoma that when the Aron was taken, there was a rock in the Kodesh HaKodeshim that the Kohen Gadol would go into the Maktik Torah and in Kippur, he would put it on the rock. So, to most, and the Rabbans and others say clearly that this rock is the location of the Kodesh HaKodeshim. This is the highest point, and that fits what the Gemara says in Yoma, that the one place where the rock, we know, protruded from the ground was in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and therefore, this is considered to many to be the location of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. In the last 100 years, some people started questioning this for various reasons. I'm not going to go into all the details because this time is not permitting. But a couple other suggestions came up. One of them is that back to that source number 7, you see an A on a small dome on the right. This was suggested by a person named Professor Kaufman from Hebrew University. It was suggested by him as the location of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. This back, and if you want to see a nice picture of this dome, go to source number 10. It's a small dome at the north at the northwestern edge of the platform, and even though the dome is clearly in the center of a tiled floor, but underneath the dome, what you see is bedrock. That is natural bedrock. Natural bedrock from the mountain, meaning over here the bedrock also rises, and according to him, this is the location of of where the Kodesh HaKodeshim was. Now this fits, if you go to source number 9, this fits with the alignment with a gate in the eastern wall of the Ha'abayis called Shaira Rachman, and it fits with a straight line, and that's why Professor Kaufman insists that that's where the Makom HaMikdash stood. It's interesting is that a lot of people like Professor Kaufman's idea, but not because they think it's correct, but it's convenient. And why is it convenient? Because if you want to build a Beis HaMikdash today, to build it where the Dome of the Rock is going to start World War III, to say the least. But if you build it in a place where the Muslims don't have any building, then maybe they'll be convinced, you know, let's build it side by side. As a matter of fact, if you go to source number 11, you even have a picture from a website where the guy has a whole design of building the Beis HaMikdash on one side, side by side next to the Dome of the Rock, as a peaceful solution. As we like to say, Shalom Yisrael, Shalom Ishmael. Everyone will have their own, their own thing, and coexist side by side. Again, wishful thinking. I'm not going to go into details like what the problems with Professor Kaufman's theory, but as I said, some people like it because it's convenient. But just because something is convenient, that doesn't make it correct. Another opinion was an opinion already of Conrad Schick in the last century, where he wanted to suggest that the Dome of the Rock, the rock in the dome, is not the Kodesh HaKodeshim, but it is the Mizbech. The Mizbech stood there. He had a lot of things to gain with this. It's also very problematic. And a fourth opinion is an opinion of a person named Tigger Sagit, an architect. And if you take him to picture number 6, to source number 6, that's a picture of Ha'abayis complete in its entirety from the air. It's only hard to discern the different levels. But the bottom right in the picture, or the bottom part of the picture, is you're looking at it over here from south to north, and the bottom part of the picture you see the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and just north of it there's an empty location, and Tzvi Sagit wants to put it over there at that empty location, right opposite the Kotel HaMaariv. The Kotel HaMaariv is on the left, and you see the plaza, and he wants to put it right opposite the Kotel HaMaariv. Now he has a lot of firm people who go along with his opinion. And the reason why they go along with his opinion is because he quotes from the Kabbalah an interesting thing. He quotes from the Kabbalah that the place of the Beis HaMikdash remains empty. And he says, therefore, the one empty place, that's the that location. Plus, that would mean that all the Jews who are davening at the Kotel HaMaariv are actually davening to the correct place where the Beis HaMikdash stood. So first of all, his source that the Api Kabbalah, that nothing's going to be built in the Kotel HaMaikdash, is a sefer called Emek HaMelech. Emek HaMelech is a Talmud from Yavid, but there's a lot of problems with the Sefer, and if you read the Sefer, if you read what he wrote properly, so he's not saying that the place of the Beis HaMikdash didn't have anything built, but he's saying the whole Ha'abayis has no buildings on it. So that's what Yavid said. So it's kind of hard to believe that Yavid would say that there's no buildings on Ha'abayis when we see buildings on Ha'abayis. So there's a problem with the Emek HaMelech, and there's a lot of problems with Sagir's theory. Now Sagir has reason why he puts it there. I'm not going into all the details. They have some good questions, but just because they have some good questions doesn't mean that we have to accept his answers to the question. I will also bring a finish off with another interesting Rashash. There's a Rashash in Baba Basra, Rav Kuk Chav Gimel, who quotes Rashi, implying from Rashi that the place of the Beis HaMikdash, Lashid Lago, is not where it is now, what's going to be farther north. Rashi doesn't say that explicitly. The Rashash understood that in Rashi because he had a problem. I don't have time to go into full details, but it's not the Hechlach, it's not inevitable that that's the way Rashi learned. The problem that Rashash had has been solved by other Achronim in other ways without moving the Makom HaMikdash. I just want to finish off that as we're getting to Tisha B'Av, we know we don't say Tachanun on Tisha B'Av. And the reason I don't say Tachanun on Tisha B'Av is because it's a merit. It's a yom tov. Call it a merit. Kind of strangest thing that the saddest day of the year is a yom tov. A merit. It's not a reason to say tachna. But the truth of the matter is that I'll tell you the story of Nech Weinberg Shlita, who was the Shiva Vasa Mech. He went on walking on the street, Eish HaTorah side. Eish HaTorah, right? And he went walking on the street, and he met by a fellow who had been in Israel and started getting close to Yiddishkeit. But the guy had a ticket to go and continue on his traveling, and that meant that he's not going to be from anymore. And he stops a knock on the street. He says, "You know, I'm leaving tomorrow, but if you give an answer to my question, then maybe I'll stay." So the knock says, "Look, I don't like being put on the spot, but okay, what's your question?" He says, "My question is," he says, "the Holocaust. How could Hashem do such a thing?" So the knock says, "Okay, let me tell you a story. I once witnessed myself. I saw a kid run across the street, not stopping to look right or left, almost gets run over by a car. The car screeches. The guy drives on his brakes. The car screeches to a halt, misses the kid by less than inches. And a few people observed this. The first person took one look and just shook his head. This is not the way he's supposed to be crossing the street. A second person saw this and he was scolded the kid a little. A third person saw this and walked over to the kid and just smacked him across the face. So Noach turns to this person and he says, "Well, let me ask you a question. Which one of these three people was the kid's father?" Obviously, the one who smacked him across the face was the one who was the kid's father. So when Hashem punishes us, and punishes us so heavily, that's not an expression of hatred, that's an expression of love. That shows Hashem's love to us. Furthermore, Chazal say that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, it was Mechapan, had the Beis HaMikdash not been able to be destroyed, then all of Kasha would have been destroyed. So by Hashem taking away the Beis HaMikdash, Am Yisrael was spared. So the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash is an expression of love for Klal Yisrael. And that's why Tisha B'Av is called a merit. So we should be zocher to merit to actually see this Yom Tov. And by the time this Tisha B'Av comes along, we'll have a Beis HaMikdash. You won't have to fast. It will be a Rishasa and a Simcha, as the Navi Zechariah predicts.